The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. My guest today is Kerwin Kay. Kay is an associate professor of sociology, American studies, and feminist gender and sexuality studies at Wesleyan University. Professor Kay is the author of a new book published by Columbia University Press entitled Enforcing Freedom, Drug Courts, Therapeutic Communities, and the Intimacies of the State. I had a fascinating conversation with Professor Kay. We're going to hear the first part of that on today's show. But first, on January 15, 2020, the House Foreign Affairs Committee held a hearing on Afghanistan. The witness was John Sopko, Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. Here is his opening statement.
Congress created SIGAR in 2008 to combat waste, fraud, and abuse in the U.S. reconstruction efforts in Afghanistan. So far, we have published over 600 audits, inspections, and other reports that have saved the American taxpayer over $3 billion while convicting over 130 individuals for misconduct related to that reconstruction effort. Although this is the 22nd time I have presented testimony to Congress since my appointment, today is the first time I have been asked to address SIGAR's rather unique lessons learned program and what we have learned from it. I thank you for that opportunity. In light of the recent attention that our reports have gotten, I am particularly pleased to have the opportunity to clear up any misconceptions about what that program does or does not do. As with everything produced by SIGAR, this lessons learned program's mandate is limited just to reconstruction, not the warfighting. We do not assess U.S. diplomatic and military strategies, nor our warfighting capabilities. Likewise, we are not producing an oral history of our involvement in Afghanistan, nor opining on whether we should or should not be there. Rather, we are the only U.S. government agency focused on conducting research and analysis which meets strict professional standards, aimed at providing an independent and objective examination of U.S. reconstruction efforts there, and to make practical recommendations to you, the Congress, and executive branch agencies for improving our efforts there and elsewhere. I'd like to mention six overarching lessons that you can draw from these thousands of pages of reports we have issued. First, that successful reconstruction is incompatible with continuing insecurity. Secondly, unchecked corruption in Afghanistan has undermined our goals there, and unfortunately, we helped foster that corruption. Third, after the Taliban's initial defeat, there was no clear reconstruction strategy and no single military service, agency, or country in charge of reconstruction efforts in Afghanistan. Fourth, politically driven timelines undermined our reconstruction efforts. Fifth, the constant turnover of U.S. personnel, or what we have euphemistically called the annual lobotomy, negatively impacted all of our reconstruction efforts there. And sixth, to be effective, reconstruction efforts must be based on a better understanding of the historical, social, legal, and political traditions of the host nation. In addition to these key lessons, your staff has asked us to give you certain recommendations that you can focus on now. And here are six. First, in light of the ongoing peace negotiations, Congress should ensure that the current administration has an actionable plan for what happens the day after peace is declared. Second, to ensure that Congress is made aware of problems in a timely manner, It should require agencies to provide regular reports to Congress disclosing risks to major reconstruction projects and programs as they occur. This would be analogous to the requirement we impose upon publicly traded corporations for the SEC. Third, Congress should condition future on-budget assistance on a rigorous assessment of the Afghan ministries and international trust funds to ensure that they have strong accountability measures in place. Fourth, oversight is still mission critical in Afghanistan. Congress must require that this administration continues to ensure adequate oversight, monitoring, and evaluation capabilities continue. Fifth, Congress should require U.S. government agencies to rack and stack their programs and projects on at least an annual basis to identify their best and worst performing programs. And sixth, Congress should require state, DOD, and USAID to submit the anti-corruption strategy for reconstruction efforts that was mandated by to be filed by June of 2018 and still has not been filed. That was mandated by the National Defense Authorization Act. So in conclusion, our work at SIGAR is far from done. For all the lives and treasure the United States and its coalition partners have expended in Afghanistan, the very least we can do is learn from our successes and failures there to improve future operations. I thank you very much for the opportunity to appear today, and I look forward to your questions.
That was John Sopko, the SIGAR, Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. He was testifying before the House Foreign Affairs Committee on January 15, 2020. Now, let's get on with the rest of the show. There's a new book from Columbia University Press, Enforcing Freedom, Drug Courts, Therapeutic Communities, and the Intimacies of the State. I happen to have the author on the phone with me now. That's Professor Kerwin Kay. Professor Kay is an associate professor of sociology, American studies, and feminist gender and sexuality studies at Wesleyan University in Connecticut. From the news release, in 1989, the first drug treatment court was established in Florida, inaugurating an era of state-supervised rehabilitation. Such courts have frequently been seen as a humane alternative to incarceration and the war on drugs. Enforcing Freedom offers an ethnographic account of drug courts and mandatory treatment centers as a system of coercion, demonstrating how the state uses notions of rehabilitation as a means of social regulation. Situating drug courts in a long line of state projects of race and class control, Kerwin Kay details the ways in which the violence of the state is framed as beneficial for those subjected to it. He explores how courts decide whether to release or incarcerate participants using nominally colorblind criteria that draw on racialized imagery. Rehabilitation is defined as preparation for low-wage labor, and the destruction of community ties with bad influence is a process that turns participants against one another. At the same time, Kay points toward the complex ways in which participants negotiate state control in relation to other forms of constraint in their lives, sometimes embracing the state's salutary violence as a means of countering their impoverishment. Enforcing Freedom offers a critical perspective on the punitive side of criminal justice reform and points toward alternative paths forward. It is all that and more, and it is really quite a pleasure and an honor to have you on the line with me, sir.
Thank you very much.
I'm reading through, I made some notes, and there are some things that I would just, if I could just ask you to unpack for the audience. You start out talking about therapeutic jurisprudence and the stratification of punishment, and talk about how drug courts act as a structure of stratified penalization, significantly intensifying the war on drugs on the non-white poor. Talk to me about this. I mean, one of the things about drug courts is the idea is it's for rehabilitation. It's for, you know, therapy, punishment, you know, treatment alternative to punishment. And yet that's not exactly how it turns out.
No, not at all. Drug courts do work out for some people, I should say. What drug courts do that is good, it really does two things that I think are positive. One, it has this vision of social inclusion that is you know, offering people services in order to have some sort of return to society. But the vision that that relies upon is that drug users are outside of society somehow, that they're already criminal, and that there's a war that can be waged against drug users. And what that means is that what the drug court is doing is just coercing people into receiving treatment in a particular way and a particular type of treatment. And what that also means then is that you can fail at treatment somehow. I would always think that treatment would fail you, but within the vision of the drug court, treatment can fail you because you're not meeting the goals of the court. So actually about half of the people going through the drug court system fail at treatment. And what happens if you fail is you've typically with the drug court, you've already had to agree to a charge. You've already had to plead guilty, and you've pled guilty to the most serious charge that they could bring to bear. So you've lost your ability to plea bargain. So now if you fail at treatment, you have already pled guilty, and now you're sentenced for the most serious charge that you could have possibly been given. And so you're now going to go to prison still, and you're spending a much longer time in prison than if you hadn't even tried to do the rehabilitative process in the first place. So you're actually punished for going through the rehabilitative process. And the half that fails are disproportionately Black, disproportionately poor. So the people that most need relief in the war on drugs are the people who actually get punished through the drug court system. Whereas people, you know, with the white working class sort of becoming more of a target within the criminal justice system around the war on drugs with the opioid epidemic and so on, those people typically get a very good deal. They make use of the services. They are able to you know, get their lives together in whatever way, and often feel that the drug court has helped them sometimes enormously. But this other half that doesn't typically get a lot of press are actually punished. And again, it's the part of the population that most needs relief from the war on drugs, and it actually intensifies the war on drugs on that half. So so drug courts are really sort of a devil's bargain in terms of it does offer these services, it offers this vision of rehabilitation instead of punishment, but the reality is for half of the people, it actually intensifies that punishment. And, you know, there's problems with the nature of the treatment itself as well, I believe, but just at the level of punishment, it can be quite devastating for the consequences.
Indeed. And well, that's one of the big concerns about drug courts, of course, is the idea of cherry picking, that the cases which are the people who are put into the drug courts are the ones who have the highest probability of what we would call treatment success. Maybe they didn't actually have a drug problem in the first place. They just got caught with some controlled substance. But that's one of the things, with the cherry picking, that you end up with, you end up either having people who don't have a real problem or going to breeze through treatment because they already have the resources. One of the things you...
Well, if I could just step in on that.
Please.
One of the things that was most surprising for me as I investigated the drug court and the treatment system is the number of people who are going through the drug courts who really do not indeed have much of a significant drug use. So what you have is a lot of people who are dealers who maybe smoke marijuana and on a regular basis, and they go into treatment through the drug court. And, you know, so in the court that I studied, it was approximately half of the people going through the drug court were dealers whose drug of choice, whose the primary drug that they used was marijuana. And in other areas, it might be a little lower, down to 30%, but still, you have a very high percentage of people going through these drug courts who really don't have necessarily a lot of involvement in drugs. And they often, the dealers, because the district attorneys have a disproportionate say in how treatment works. So most drug courts offer inpatient treatment, they offer outpatient treatment, but the dealers, because of public safety concerns, not because of any criteria around drug addiction or anything like that. Because of public safety concerns, the district attorneys often insist that dealers go to residential treatment, the most intensive types of treatment available, such that the treatment centers sort of become like mini jails and are really used for different purposes than they were intended for. Now, often the dealers that I spoke with who are going through treatment, they're able to make use of these services and find it a, you know, less onerous way of doing their time than spending time in jail. So from that perspective, it's not necessarily the worst option, but for them at least. But this is really something dramatically different, and it does alter the numbers in terms of the quote success rates of what treatment is. And again, we can talk a bit what does success mean in terms of treatment for these programs and so on. But it's really a very different population than I think people think of going through drug treatment initially. It's really often, you know, a large percentage of people who really don't have significant involvement, as well as people who do, of course, but a lot more people who are just using marijuana.
We'll have more of my conversation with Professor Kerwin Kay, author of Enforcing Freedom, in just a moment. You are listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh.
Our young people are helping us lead the way.
We are out here today because we are sick and tired of politicians prioritizing their NRA donations over student lives.
Of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop, and you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Let's return to my conversation with Kerwin Kay, Associate Professor of Sociology at Wesleyan University and the author of Enforcing Freedom, Drug Courts, Therapeutic Communities, and the Intimacies of the State. What can we do? What are the things we can do to look out for? What should drug courts be doing to be better? How can we do better?
Well, a lot of the problem with drug courts really happens in the fine print, and it's really tricky to evaluate. So part of the, for example, one thing, with most drug courts, you're pleading guilty ahead of time. And so that if you, quote, fail at treatment, you've now lost your ability to plea bargain. You've pled guilty to the most serious charge that they could level. And now you're going to prison with no credit for the time that you've put in into the treatment process. So some things that you could do and that a small percentage of drug courts do is you could have the plea bargaining still be an option. You could have people go through the court process, the drug court process, without having to plead guilty ahead of time. You could make sure that people receive credit for the time that they put in treatment as part of any sentence that they might receive, and make the treatment, you know, directly part of the treatment, and just basically make sure that people are not punished for any time that they put in attempting to participate in a rehabilitation program. That is the most simple thing. And I guess for me, I'd like to move away from the entire criminal justice system as part of the way that we adjudicate any sort of drug crimes. Basically, I'd like to move towards a public health model that emphasizes harm reduction. I'd like to see a lot of the services that the drug court offers, some of which are very good, treatment on demand we could have, but also job training, whether you're involved in the criminal justice system or not. Just make job training of various sorts available on demand as people want it. Help with people getting a GED and other sort of assistance to our entirely dysfunctional education system more generally. These are all things that could be offered, without forcing people to go through these programs. And, you know, the advocates of drug courts argue that people will not go through treatment unless they're forced to. And my response is, well, that could be true in some cases. But when you force people to go through treatment, you've got a lot of downsides, a lot of negatives that start to add up. So all the people that are going into treatment that, quote, fail because they've been forced and they're not responding the way that you want them to, those people are ending up in prison for long periods of time. So where do you put that on the ledger sheet? So overall, I think that the ledger sheet is much more in favor of a public health approach focused on harm reduction, focused on offering services, focusing on restructuring the economy, and doing, rather than continuing to use the criminal justice system as part of this plan of racialized poverty management, basically. Moving away from that entire model. So I'd like to see, no need for drug courts, because why are we punishing drug crimes in the first place? Nevertheless, I could see some places where even in an abolitionist model, it's hard for me to figure out exactly how we would get around not having some sort of adjudicatory procedure, for example, around DUIs. And if somebody wants to continue driving, for example, and they have a history of driving drunk a lot, I could understand I'd rather see a court model that offered services as part of what they were doing than not. So in that sense, I could see, a drug court model that could work in some limited situations, even if we were able to change things more dramatically. But sort of generally, I think we need to move away from relying on the criminal justice system as a whole. Part of what the drug court does is it reinforces the idea that we need to keep arresting people. In fact, it says that arresting people is a good thing. This is how we get to offer them treatment. This is how we get to offer them help. And it turns arrest and the threat of imprisonment, turns that into a benefit. And in fact, part of the way that we started this conversation talking about therapeutic jurisprudence, the therapeutic part, it sort of medicalizes punishment. It medicalizes the criminal justice system. It doesn't mean that doctors or addiction specialists are really in charge of handling people's cases. But what it does is it turns punishment into a form of medicine. And so that the way that we hold people accountable, the main problem is that people are not being held accountable. And the way we hold people accountable is by using these very basic criminal justice system tools like arrest and imprisonment, and turns that into something that is actually beneficial for people in dealing with their drug problems. And that, I think, is entirely wrong. So I think in terms of what we can do, I think we need to continue to push towards a public health model, towards harm reduction models, and away from drug courts in general. What can be challenging, though, I think, is when, for example, in New York State in 2009, they changed the rules. They overturned, but they significantly modified the Rockefeller drug laws. in favor of judicial diversion, so in favor of basically a drug court model. And you have to ask, was that an improvement? Was that a step in the right direction? Or are we actually intensifying the war on drugs for the half of the people that fail? Is this a move in the wrong direction? I think the answer is that it's actually very complicated and it's hard to assess. And the answer a lot of times is in the fine print. I sort of think of drug courts as a deal with the devil. And when you deal with the devil, you really better pay attention to the fine print about what's going on. So for example, some changes that have happened since 2009's change to the drug laws in New York. Now the prosecutors tend to offer plea bargains very differently. They don't want people to have the opportunity to, at least some people, they don't want them to have the opportunity to be diverted into a drug program. And so they're actually hewing much more toward harsher penalties that keep people out of the track where they might be diverted into drug treatment. So you can have some unintended effects also that happen as part of these processes. So, you know, in New York's case, I'd say, you know, there's been a lot of positives that we could say in terms of a lot of people have been diverted from criminal justice entirely. And it's complicated. I think overall, it's probably been a good change in New York, but it's really complicated. And it's in the mess of details that you have to look for the answers for that, whether this is even a positive step. So, you know, there are other drug courts have become a model for other types of courts, mental health courts, prostitution courts, even truancy courts, where they're threatening children with short-term incarceration if they don't show up in school, or threatening their parents with the same. So each of these, I think truancy courts are just a bad idea. But with mental health courts, I think it's like really complicated, the effects of each of these courts and how they play out. And it's really in the fine details whether, you know, I think it's not ultimately the good model of what we'd like to move for. But even in terms of assessing, is this a move forward or a move backwards? I think it's really complicated and really involved in the weeds that you have to get into to figure out, is this particular court going to be a benefit in this city?
That was part of my conversation with Professor Kerwin Kay. Kay is an associate professor of sociology, American studies, and feminist gender and sexuality studies at Wesleyan University, and the author of Enforcing Freedom, Drug Courts, Therapeutic Communities, and the Intimacies of the State. We'll have more from that conversation on next week's show. For now, that's it. I want to thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. The executive producer of the Drug Truth Network is Dean Becker. Drug Truth Network programs, including this show, Century of Lies, as well as the flagship show of the Drug Truth Network, Cultural Baggage, and of course our daily 420 Drug War News segments, are all available by podcast. The URLs to subscribe are on the network homepage at drugtruth.net. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For now, for the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.